Good morning.
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 Morning, Tim.
Sorry, I was late. I had to go fix my hair.
Fair enough. Well, did you iron your shirt too, Tim?
Oh, yeah, I was a little taken aback by that comment. Also, I thought it was kind of funny he made this insult about my children having graduated from high school, but did any of them go to college? Oh, yeah, well, three of them have advanced degrees. Yeah, I guess they went to college. Oh, well. I didn't hear anything from my friend today, so maybe he'll give me a break here.
Don't get too excited.
Nope. Is Doug's going to be with us this morning, right?
Yeah, but he thought he might have a little, you know, he was dealing with some cattle stuff, so he thought he might be in and out. So we may be all right to start without him. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're right. He was talking about he was going to have he was doing an online cattle sale today. So
yeah,
I think we should assume that that's what he's doing and he'll catch up with us when he can. So, I guess what's our agenda? It's just COVID-19 and then
Board of Health at 10, I believe.
Yeah, so we basically have 30 minutes to kill here. What do we want to talk about?
Well, I have, I can just give you an update on the Protect Our Neighbors conversation, which actually Doug was there because it was during the policy group call. Mark was there as well. so just briefly, you know, just shared with them the framework, kind of what we're looking at, and that the places where we have some gaps that we would like support with are specifically around compliance, and talked about just, you know, our goal is to have a plan that we believe gets us a high level of compliance. And that doesn't necessarily mean enforcement. It means enforcement when necessary, but it also means education and monitoring. And so that was a place where I requested that the municipalities consider what resources they might be able to make available. And I know Mark is having a follow-up conversation today, just with Steamboat Mark or with the others as well?
It's everybody has indicated that they can attend. I'm a little bit nervous, Beth, that I heard yesterday on that call, the policy call, that Matt was out of town this week, but then I got an email from Matt this morning. So
yeah, I don't know what's up with that, but
yeah, but otherwise everybody is supposed to be on the call. You bet.
Okay. Well, that's even better news. And so just saying that, you know, there was some concern expressed just about capacity of law enforcement. Hayden, you know, Tim Redmond indicated that their police chief is saying that he's seen a 30% increase in calls outside of public health. I know Chief Christensen, I thought, had said they were down this year, and dispatch seems to be saying they're down. So I don't know exactly what the story is with that, but there were some concerns expressed about capacity. Kathy asked about, you know, funding for if law enforcement needs overtime. And I said, well, the CARES Act funding would definitely cover that, Kathy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Kathy who?
Meyer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then she did say, which I totally agree with her, you know, she said, we don't want to be the mask police. And I really just said, you know, we're not talking about we need to police masks. It's we need to make sure people are following the rules across the board. And that has to do with gatherings. It has to do with social distancing. It's all those things. It's not we need 100% compliance with masks and that's our goal. It's to make sure there's a high enough level of compliance to keep people safe. So that's what I shared. And then also Carrie had requested that we see if perhaps there could be some sort of surge capacity, if you will, for contact tracing, that maybe we have some municipal staff trained as backup in the situation where we have a big need for contact tracing. And there was some interest from those Hayden especially expressed that they would be willing to do that. So we're going to follow up with Carrie on how we can make that happen so that we have kind of backup contact tracers. You know, obviously they can't commit the 20 to 40 hours a week consistently for the contact tracer that the contract tracers we're hiring can, but they could theoretically be available if we had, you know, a situation where we needed a lot of contact tracing for a short period of time. So want to work with them on that. So that was the bulk of the conversation. The other piece is just the grants that are available. So there's a planning grant, and I didn't really talk with them about this yesterday. I wanted to talk to you guys about kind of what our appetite is for this. There's a $50,000 planning grant, which I think that's basically a no-brainer. We just apply for that, figure out what we can use it for, and apply for it. And then, but the other one is the infrastructure building grant, I think they're calling it. And it's up to $150,000, but it does require a local match. And they did just yesterday put up the applications for those two grants. So I think we can take a look at what they're thinking that money can be used for and figure out, you know, if it makes sense for us. Definitely the planning grant makes sense as far as I'm concerned, but the other one, we just need to decide what the value of it will be. You know, I feel like $150,000 is $150,000, and we're probably going to be spending the other $150,000 regardless of whether we get that grant or not. We just need to look at what it can be used for and decide it, how we would apply. Because I think, you know, some of the things like building out these education activities and I think there's stuff that we're already going to be doing. So it probably does make sense to apply. On the planning grant, personally, you know, I don't see a world where we just hire a consultant to do figure out protect our neighbors and then move on. I think what we would want to use it for is a couple of things. One, I would love for each of us plus the municipalities to just get some of that money for staff time to work on planning for protect our neighbors. I think those are going to be the best planning people we have. And I think the money is flexible enough that we could do that. And then Carrie had indicated that really what we should do is pay someone to write the mitigation and containment plan, which is the bulk of the application. And she did have someone in mind who might be able to do that. So I don't know if we would need to do an RFP or if it could just be a sole source based on, you know, this person that Carrie has identified as maybe being the best fit for it. But that would sort of be my recommendation, is that we take a look at how we can reimburse staff time for doing this planning rather than use an outside consultant. And then we pay someone to do the mitigation planning. The other thing that's in there that I'm not sure about is there's kind of this concept of like community engagement and somehow funding that. And I'm having trouble picturing what it is we really would need in terms of like having community meetings and input and why that would cost us any money other than staff time, that kind of thing. So I'll probably just maybe talk with Carrie about that and maybe ask some other counties how they're looking at that. But those are sort of my thoughts and kind of still just working through it, obviously, but would welcome any thoughts, or if you just want that as an update, that's fine too.
I have a couple of comments. Number one, the $50,000 planning grant sounds like a complete no-brainer. I mean, there's no question that it's going to require a lot of time by somebody to put together the framework to enter Protect Our Neighbors, or as you have pointed out, just working within that framework, even if we don't actually apply to enter, to expand our public health capacity. So I'm not sure exactly what we need to do to apply for that grant.
Literally a Google form. It's like super straightforward. It's just we have to decide what we're requesting the money for and put together a budget.
So that's going to deserve some conversation. And then the second comment I have is regarding compliance efforts around the county in partnership with our other municipalities. It seems like, for very good reason, that with Robin here working with us, that we've obviously been the point of the spear in terms of community communication. And to the extent, I'm not sure what this would look like, but it would be really nice if our municipalities were working in partnership, collaboration, coordination with us on any and all of this messaging. And that's certainly, they have CARES money, and if they need to devote some staff time to help out with that, that sounds like a good idea. And I'd be curious to know what Robin thought about that, but I don't even need to hear that right now. That's just my two comments.
On your second point, I do believe that that is actually one of the things that bigger infrastructure building grant, that it specifically indicated it could be used for. So just something to think about. And what I'm picturing as we go through this is, I think, you know, Robin's had some participation and conversation and whatever with these other folks, but I'm picturing that we get something, maybe it's not as formal as an MOU, but kind of an agreement, you know, that we submit with our application. And it is requiring letters from each municipality, from the sheriff, from each of the police chiefs. And I think those letters outline, like, these are the activities that we are going to undertake to support this public health effort. And I think getting to the agreement about what those activities are is the work in my
Are you referring to the agreement to enter Protect Our Neighbors, or that's what we
Protect Our Neighbors.
No, okay, that's not to get the $50,000 grant.
No, that. But I think the $50,000 would be used to support the efforts to get to those agreements. There actually was a reference in there to spending some of that money on contracting work too, if you needed to write contracts between various entities, that kind of thing.
So I guess if that's the direction we want to go, we would need to spend just a little bit of time compiling the items that we think we would be using that $50,000 to pay for.
Yeah, and I just looked at the application yesterday afternoon, and so I need to go back and spend a little more time with it and see exactly what we can use it for. But yes, I think it's pretty straightforward, and we can do that.
Okay.
And like you said, the $50,000 is a no-brainer. The other, I think we need to talk more about, because there's the local match required. But it's okay, because it's meant to be sort of a two-step thing.
Can we use our CARES funding as the local?
Yeah, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that, if that's the case, that also starts to turn into a no-brainer.
Yeah, agreed. And like I said, I think that other $150,000 would be money we'd be spending on something anyway. You know, I don't think it's somehow like new stuff that we wouldn't otherwise need to be spending money on. Doug, I was just giving an update on Protect Our Neighbors. I know you were there yesterday, so you already know most of this, but I don't know if there's any other comments you want to make.
No, other than the fact that, you know, I guess Mark's going to meet with them later this with the managers as well. That'd
today,
be good. Yeah. I didn't see anybody scrambling out the door, but I didn't see anybody trying to get in either. And oh yeah, no, we'll help. We're all behind you. I didn't see any of that either. So it's kind of like, okay, well, Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we could do something like that.
I don't know. Well, I think I heard Mark earlier say something about bending elbows. So
yeah, that's good.
I mean, of course, like, unless we ask them, why would they start dedicating resources to this? You know, I get it. All of us have, our resources are thin, but you know, what I said to them yesterday, I think is true, which is just, it's going to take all of us. Like, normally the county has to be fully responsible for public health, but the scale of this is so large that everybody has to pitch in if we're going to be successful. So,
and again, I'm still a little dense here. I can be quite dense, but I'm still trying to figure out what the benefit is, you know, and making sure, and I don't know, it's not black and white yet to me. So,
no, good. I mean, the benefit, as far as I can tell, the benefit is local control. And we have to decide, you know, we have to decide what that, you know, truly what the benefit of that is. But I will say, if you open the application for Protect Our Neighbors, it's even more explicit than anything else. Or no, they put something out yesterday. I don't remember what it was. But the first line was, most counties in Colorado will not yet be eligible to apply for Protect Our Neighbors because you have to have declining case counts. And so, like, who knows, you know?
Well, that just supports the concept of moving in that direction no matter what, because the framework is, as you've said and I've said, appears to be a good framework that makes a lot of sense. And there's no reason not to go ahead and start doing the things that are involved with that. Mark, refresh my memory.
Getting out of the room right as you said his name, Tim. He was great.
Refresh my memory. Did we schedule some kind of a follow-up meeting of the allocation committee for any further discussions, or we're just waiting till October?
Tim, your memory is excellent. We decided.
No, it's not. That's why I'm asking the question.
We decided that it would be a good idea if we did just a monthly update. If you recall, you said.
I'm recalling now.
I'm concerned that we go all the way to October before we check in and see how we're doing. So we thought it was a good idea to set what we would call progress meetings. So the next one that you might also recall that you decided that would be a good idea would be sometime around latter part of July. So that should be coming up here in just a matter of a few weeks.
Next week on the 15th, and it's the third Wednesday every week or every month.
Great. And you're right. I think that's on my calendar. Thanks, Kendra. So yeah, I think it would be a good idea for us to get together on that kind of basis to just have some conversations, how individually we are spending that money and share some ideas and best practices. And it's also it's just a good opportunity to talk about how we're approaching the dollars without getting in the way of what Beth is trying to do in terms of organizing the framework.
Yeah, and I think it'll be good for all of you to have updates on, you know, what that money is being spent on. I continue to think there's value, not in tooting our own horn necessarily, but just in demonstrating the work that we're doing related to public health. And I think it's just an important reminder to everyone about the amount of work and money and effort that's going into this response, to just continue to share what we're
spending. And I think it's also
what they're spending money on.
You know, I see it working pretty well in parallel with what you're doing, because just like you said, not to toot our own horn, but to emphasize that, at least in Route County's case, the money that we're spending is really direct to the public health issue, and encourage our partners to make sure that they're not dreaming up items that may be not really directly beneficial, unless they've got so much money left over to spend. But in particular, the idea of providing us help with contact tracers, they've got some money to spend on that. And in my view, that should be one of their priorities.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
those are my updates there. Sorry, Doug.
If we have those guys having contact tracers and paying it out of their scales and their wages and the rest, how's that communication scheme going to work with be reporting to Carrie then, evidently? Then.
So, Doug, I think we have to work out the details of that. But the way that Carrie had, you know, I mentioned just on the recovery team, I said, you know, what other support could we use? Is there any way, you know, is there any way they could potentially support with contact tracing? And what Carrie said is it would be great if they could provide sort of a surge capacity for contact tracing. So maybe we train some folks on their staff. And it's really just, they're not doing the 20 to 40 hours a week that our hired contact tracers are doing, but that maybe, you know, if we had a big need on 1 week or whatever, that they could step up and help. But I do think you're right. We'll have to figure out what the, you know, is that just on their salary time? Is it then they're getting paid by us for what they're doing during that time? And then how do we make sure that the accountability is there in the right place? But I think we're just picturing that they would provide some kind of backup capacity more than anything else.
Yeah, that will be in the details, because especially if they're going to use their CARES money they'll have to pay for it and be their expense. And I don't know.
That's just an accounting issue for them, just like it has been for us. If you have a staff member that spends 15 hours doing something like that, they just account for it and apply for reimbursement. But you are right, how the reporting mechanism and the structure of that back to public health, I'm sure there's some details there that would need to be ironed out.
So I'm going to just assume that Kathy is here so that we can get an update on staffing. Am I right about that, Mark?
Yeah, I'm on.
I just assumed that's why you were on. I knew you were on.
And you know what? We've only got 7 minutes left until our 10 a.m. public health. So if you guys don't have any objection, good point, Beth. Let's have Kathy give us an update.
So we have started posting for the contact tracer position, and we've already started getting a number of applications for that. Mark, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the things that this is off tangent on the recruiting piece, but I just looked through hours that were logged for contact tracers over the last few months, and they don't work a lot. Like maybe the data is incomplete, but it doesn't look like there are a lot of hours spent each week for contact tracers based on the reports that I have seen. We're proceeding with hiring, you know, the number that Carrie's interested in. And if people can work 20 hours, then Carrie has indicated, based on data that she's reviewed, that we would need probably 14 or 15 of those people. If the people are working 20 hours a week, they would, you know, then, or 40 hours a week, then we would probably need 8 or 9. My concern is that I know that some of these volunteers, and I don't know what else they do besides working at Rauch County on contact tracing. There's been information that's been shared that they are, you know, that some of them are getting burnt out. And I get that it's a high intensity job, but if I look at the hours that they're working, and some people are maybe, you know, I think the maximum that one person was working in 1 week was 10.5 hours. I do have concerns that, can somebody really carry out the job 40 hours in a week? And do we really have that need?
I would like to speak, if I may. This is Carrie. I did join a few Early. Hi, Kathy. So what I would say to that is that Michelle and I have picked up a lot of the contact tracing because the volunteers have not been available when we've needed them. And so because those hours are reflected does not mean that that's all the work that has gone into contact tracing. One of the issues that we've run into with people not being paid is that they don't have the availability that we have needed. So Michelle and I ended up working this weekend. Like for example, over the 4th of July weekend, she and I ended up doing the contact tracing because our volunteers weren't available. So I think to take into consideration the number of hours Michelle and I have individually been putting in on top of the volunteer hours, we would have to do that to compute anything that's even comparable to what's been going on.
Okay, that is super helpful information, Carrie, because that was something that was confusing me. So that is very helpful. Do you think if our people are working 40 hours a week, they're going to burn out and maybe we should be, you know, should we be paying attention to if they will have that ability to do that based on the intensity of the job?
Well, I think that one of the things that we'll be able to tell pretty quickly on these positions that have already, you know, expressed interest. I did get an email from somebody that had, she had already completed her certification, is how efficient they are with not only contacting the close contacts, but staying in contact with them, because that's part of the piece that I'm worried about is with the volunteers, there is a regimen of, you know, day one, day three, day five, day seven, day 11 check-ins with people to monitor them. And so I think we're going to have to gauge if they truly are, these people truly are doing all the components, and it is, you know, I regret that I can fully say that they are not doing all the components they need to be right now because they're volunteers, then we'll have an idea of how much time it'll actually take for somebody to do it.
Okay, that's great. And we've been getting a really good response in human resources as far as people interested in this role. So we should be getting applications to you today that you can start looking at. As far as the epidemiologist goes, we are going to advertise for, Carrie, you listed an epidemiologist / data manager. And you indicated that mid-level epidemiologist job description would be a good match for that role. So we're proceeding with that, and we should have that in the newspaper tomorrow. And that'll get posted tomorrow. Go ahead.
Kathy, there's actually somebody that is one of the contact tracers who's interested, who is an epidemiologist, and he has 15 years of experience in epidemiology. And it has done a great job with what he's done with the contact tracing. So he has already reached out to me to see if there are positions that he might be able to do even on a temporary basis.
So Mary, this is Mark. I wondered because, you know, Kathy and I had several conversations yesterday and specifically about the epidemiologist position. Is it an expectation that individual, Carrie, would do the data management duties that Michelle has picked up over the last several months? Because Dr. Harrington and I talked about that late yesterday, that Michelle was doing yeoman's work on all that data collection and all that data management. If we have an epidemiologist that comes on board, would that individual do those duties and those functions?
Yes, and that even in the job description that Kathy, we had traded emails about, it outlines the data component of it, and so that would be the expectation, they would do both of those functions.
Super, that's what we thought as we reread the descriptive elements of that with the good examples you provided to us, Carrie, that's exactly what we thought, so that's great, that's super news, great, thank you.
So, one question on that, Carrie. Given what you know, and I haven't seen the job description, I guess I'm just curious, you know, we've talked about that some of that work is maybe sort of below the pay grade of our nurse. Is it appropriate for an epidemiologist to be spending a lot of time like making phone calls to clinics and doing all those things? Or does it make sense for that to be a separate role? I mean, are we going to end up with the same issue, I guess, where it's just so much of their time is taken up on what are basically administrative type tasks that are problematic?
I think what would be really good is for that person to set up systems, like a processes for all of that. And then if we can have clerical support for the actual phone calls to follow up, like when they have to call the clinics to check on data and all of that. But what I talked to Dr. Harrington this morning about is there's a lot of mapping that should be happening right now with the cases and those kinds of things that could happen through the epidemiologist, which pairs with the data management. And then if there are, you know, like you mentioned, those simple tasks, I think we can farm those to somebody else. I mean, Stella would be able to do that. Stella could call some of these places too. It's just it's a matter of compiling the information, figuring out what we need and establishing processes for the collection of the data.
Well, and really my question, and I think you answered it, but I just want to be more explicit. Do you need additional administrative support in addition to this epidemiological position, or do you believe that you will have adequate administrative support to do those types of tasks that Michelle has been completing?
There will be adequate administrative support. What I need support with is setting it up so that the administrative people know what to do.
And that role, the description on that role is there's significant content in there for the expectations that they would be setting up processes to support all of the data analysis that needs to take place.
So I have a couple questions, Carrie. So how many contact tracers are we hiring right now? And then when we hire them, what happens to the volunteers and the rest? Are they still gonna be on helping? And I thought we were also talking about giving them some type of stipend for the time worked or whatever as well, not necessarily living off the free dime here. So, and again, how this is all gonna match up. And then I guess my third question, are all of these people gonna be reporting to you?
So the idea is to convert the people from volunteers into having some reimbursement structure if they're interested. And I guess a question to Kathy is, a few of the contact tracers have asked to remain as volunteers, and I presume that's okay unless there's some sort of an HR reason why they can't.
So Eric and I have talked a little bit about this regarding other positions where people wanted to be remain volunteers, but yet, for example, election judges, where we're paying some of them, and a couple people wanted to remain volunteers. We decided that we wanted to pay everyone because further on down the line, we wanted to make sure that it showed that we were treating people equitably and that, maybe somebody would have regrets that they weren't paid. And so we believe we should pay everybody.
Okay. So then back to, I guess, Commissioner Monger's question. So I've requested that there be 9 contact tracers who are paid for their time. And what Kathy and I talked about with Mark is for them to have an hourly rate for the time that they're working actually on cases, and then an on-call rate of $3 an hour to be on call for the rest of the time. And I think that'll mitigate the issue that we've run into with them not being available for us to access, like for example, over a holiday weekend. It makes sense. People don't want to be available during that time. But the on-call, the idea with the on-call is to keep people on board with working.
No, that sounds good. That's what I wanted to hear. Yeah, so that we have and treating them fairly as well. And are you, I guess then the other question back, I mean, still 9 people reporting to you and the rest, are you going to have like a lead contract tracer or something like that?
Yep. So we had 2 lead contact tracers and we now have 1. The other one has taken a step back, but the primary one that I've been working with the past few days has expressed interest in remaining in that role and being paid.
At a differential rate, I assume, than the rest of them.
That's a good point. We haven't delineated out any difference for him. Kathy, maybe you and I should talk about that because he does have more of the responsibility as far as coordinating all these people.
Is that person equivalent to what Paula's been doing? Because Paula and I did talk about that yesterday, and it seemed like the, you know, adding basically the timekeeping process or collecting timesheets, which this person wouldn't, I don't think would have, would they, I don't know if they would still, to what degree they would still have to do that. And I think they were submitting documentation to the SO to do background checks. And I have to say that it didn't seem like it was a significant change in the scope of work unless I've been misinformed.
Let me jump in here. We are running a little bit over into our public health update time, although I think that's okay because this is clearly a public health issue that we're talking about. And I'd like to ask one other question to Kathy and to Carrie, which is, what's involved in onboarding these employees? And are we needing to provide them with laptop computers, or are they able to perform their functions without laptops? And how long does it take to onboard these people after we hire them?
So in human resources, we've already started onboarding them. So there are people that are hired who will now get paid. And Carrie, you and I should talk about how that transition should work, or if they're just going to report to you and you've already got them dialed in to work. But the four people who had already submitted applications before we posted the job are in the process. I think all of them have been hired. Kelsey has carried out the onboarding process. We've talked to Robert about how equipment is going to get used. We will be, they will be not getting telephones, but we will be reimbursing them. We will be allowing them to get a stipend for the use of their phones. And I will be honest, Carrie, I can't remember what we decided regarding laptops for them or if they even needed them.
Yeah, I can speak to that. So when we met with Robert, he felt comfortable that these people have been using their own devices, and that's okay as long as they have a Rout County email address, which he's in the process of setting up. And then we also talked about the need for encryption. And so he's checking into additional licenses for the protected trust encryption service that Michelle and I and Dr. Harrington trade emails through. And so he's seeing if that's an option to just add that to their email account as an option.
So what I'm hearing is that there's not any insurmountable obstacles or anything that's too terribly time consuming in getting these folks up and running.
I think we can confirm that we have a process.
I'm not sure that
that's
you
answered. Not what Tim asked.
Yeah, let me be more specific.
How long does the process take?
Well, it is hiring 14 or 9 or however many people we're going to hire is, you know, it's a time-consuming process. They go through a standard orientation like a normal employee would have to, because they have to sign off on all our forms. But it's completely doable. And I think the most important thing is that we have a good process that we're following. And I think that's a good practice.
So for instance, Kathy, the four individuals that were in the process of hiring as of today, when do you expect any of those four individuals to be up and running and performing contact tracing duties?
My understanding is that at least, I'd have to look at my notes, but at least two of them could be doing it today.
Okay, that's good enough for me. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, as you have new applications coming in, how quickly, and I understand this is a lot of people, so it may be a range, but you know, how long are we looking at before folks are up and running generally?
So my understanding, and I will follow up with Kelsey, but we've been in the process of forwarding applications typically as they come in to the department head. So I would say that, you know, it may not be every hour, but it could be by the end of the day. Carrie will have a list of applications that she can review. We deliberately listed in the job description that we will be reviewing applications immediately and will be hiring immediately as well. So we will not be waiting for the job to close before we start looking at these and making decisions. the job may close and we may have already hired everybody that we need.
Well, I'm finding some comfort in your responses, Kathy, especially the fact that there's already two people that have basically made it through the process here in a relatively short period of time. And so presumably that will continue. And in the near future, we'll have most of these positions filled and up and running.
Yeah, the only reason why we may not have four people is because Kelsey's still trying to get all their forms signed off on, but they, you know, they're hired.
And Kathy, I appreciate the fact that we do have a process, that it does need to be followed, that we cannot just willy-nilly put people on the payroll and worry about the details later. So I'm supportive of the process and that it does need to take place. And it sounds to me like you're doing everything you can to accelerate that process.
Thank you.
Before we move off staffing, I just want to ask one other question. Carrie, are there other unmet staffing needs that we haven't addressed in this conversation?
I would like to talk about the health educator positions. I came in late, so I don't know if those were already talked about.
Nope, we did not discuss them.
Okay, so the health educator positions really are to support the both the environmental health department and the public health department with all these questions that come in about business best practices within business and providing education and also providing education out to the community about COVID. And so I had sent the job description for those positions and then also had some conversations with Kathy and Mark off and on, as well as with Dan about those. So I just was wondering what the status of those are.
So that is following the epidemiologist data manager position. I have the job description that you are interested in having us use. I didn't have a ton of salary information. I basically reached out to Weld County again because they're the ones that provided us with those examples. And so I just saw an email come in from their HR director giving me some of their salary information because I want to make sure that we have some options. So you and I will have to look at that and make a determination there. My understanding was we were only recruiting one health educator, or are we recruiting more than that?
I requested two.
You did. Okay.
So what's the process in that? And all of that.
In what?
So the process of requesting to. Who did we re-request that to? Did that go to Mark or what? And all of this needs a supplemental budget, even if it's coming through the CARES money. So I guess we just want to make sure we know what we're doing here.
So what I have been, what I've been communicating is really wanting an informal approval from the commissioners on the salary selection that we're making, and then come back and do a formal agenda item because this is moving so quickly. And I will say with the contact tracers, I'm not sure there was that happened, but we needed to get that posted. And so that's, I guess I'm doing a forgiveness process based on
wink and a nod, we call it.
Called it a forgiveness process, Doug.
So if I could, commissioners, touch on a couple things. Quite formally, we need to come back to you, the commissioners, with all of these positions we've discussed, because we still have the hiring freeze, and we have specified within the resolution for that hiring freeze that we bring positions back for you for your final approval and confirmation. So that's that phase, that piece that Kathy talked about, but we've been moving at in an incredibly rapid pace to be able to get these out the door and get everybody onboarded as quickly as can, because we've got an emergency situation. The other piece that I just want to remind everybody of on the health educators, and this is especially, Carrie, is one reason we're having this conversation at 2:30 this afternoon. In my conversation this afternoon with the other managers and administrators, that's one specific arena that I really want to lean on people to say, can you supply us with help in terms of these health educators. And I want to see just exactly what we can collect, what we can glean from that before maybe we go ahead and we onboard some people, that we may have some people in our current capacity that we can utilize. The other question to you, Carrie, is it possible that the contact tracers that we onboard in the next several days, would they also be able to go ahead and be a health educator? Could they wear that hat as well? Because it doesn't seem like maybe that needs to be necessarily a full-time position. Could they actually be in multiple roles? Because they'd already be on our payroll. We'd already be onboarded and we'd already have vetted them. I'm just kind of wondering if that might be an option.
So let me interrupt. I feel like we're getting into the weeds of human resources, and we only have about 45 minutes left for our update. And I think some of the issues that have been raised are great points of conversation for the county manager to conduct with staff. But if you two, Doug and Beth, don't object, I think I'd like to move on from this conversation.
So I guess, you know, my fear here is that I'm good with those contact tracers and the rest. I'm a little troubled with the health educators and the rest, and then two of them. So, you know, I haven't been sold on that. And I don't know what we're going to educate, because everybody's an expert on COVID-19. So everybody's an expert already. So
well, I think, yeah, I would just, it sounds like, I mean, we did review the initial request from Carrie, which included the contact tracers and the epidemiology, and we expressed our support for those positions. The commissioners have not had an opportunity to review what these health educators would be doing and to approve that. So I would agree with Doug that it would be good for us to be able to understand that a little better beyond just supplementing what environmental health is doing right now. I don't think that's the full range of what Carrie is picturing, and it would probably just be worth a little more time talking about it. But Tim, I respect what you're saying, because I know we have to be done at 11, so.
Yeah,
Thank you. Yep.
I think that it feels like we provided adequate direction to staff to be able to move forward with this. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to our weekly public health update. And I see that we have Dr. Harrington here, and of course Carrie's here, so I would turn it over to public health.
So I'll go ahead and get started with just a couple updates. As far as our testing, we have 86 people coming through community testing today. And so we have a kind of an eclectic mix today of symptomatic people, a handful of asymptomatic people, and then also we're doing some close contacts of positive cases as well. And just to give you an overview of what's going on with the testing, we on Sunday set up a pop-up testing at Casey's Pond for residents and staff there due to them having identified a positive staff member. And then on Monday, we did a clinic for all the close contacts of the positive and other positives that came from the week before as well. And then yesterday, we did testing at the B&K distributor and then also for Rex's, because we've been pretty heavily involved in the Rex's testing. And Friday, we're going to do the ski area. We're doing the food and beverage area of the ski resort. And I think overall, what we're finding is we're gonna continue to work on the strategy with the testing to really have symptomatic people go see their physicians and recommend that they're going to be seen by either their physician or UC Health. And then our niche will be more of the outbreak response, the close contact testing, and then I'd like to get more to the real macro level population health asymptomatic testing. And so that continues to evolve, but it's essentially for the protecting our neighbors statistics and all of that. And Dr. Harrington and Emmy, I think, are planning to go into this a little bit more, but we really want to just make sure that there is the capacity within the community, the entire community, to be able to test per day the number of tests, the number of people that we need to, and then focus on these small outbreaks or these cluster cases and all those close contacts through public health testing. And then in addition, I just wanted to highlight that starting July 1st, all of these contracts that we previously had for the year, this past year, have been renewed. And so starting now, we are responsible for the deliverables within those contracts. And so we need to, I'm orienting Michelle to the other public health work that needs to be happening as far as maternal child health, the immunizations work, which I think we could probably have an entire board of health devoted to the immunizations contract, but the Moffitt County public health nurse and then the nurses here and I are gonna attend a Zoom tuberculosis case management for COVID training because tuberculosis is still part of our repertoire of public health services that we need to be monitoring and surveying for the community. So just to reiterate that we have now, it's time in July to begin all of these deliverables for all the other contracts in addition to the COVID work. So I just wanna make sure that we are good stewards of the funding that we're receiving through the other contracts and are executing on all the deliverables we need to. So I think I'll turn it over to Dr. Harrington. I think he and Emmy were gonna present on the dashboard.
Can I ask you a couple questions, yeah. Terry, first, just before we get into that? My first question, I know that we sort of stopped recruiting volunteers for that kind of community surveillance testing. Mm-hmm. Are we still accepting volunteers and just not actively trying to recruit them? Or are we really only testing people who are symptomatic or have had contact in addition to the businesses?
Yeah, so this week we just focused on symptomatic testing and we did take some asymptomatic patients who are already scheduled or really wanted to be tested. And so what we decided for next week is, and we will work with Robin on this, as far as the messaging out, what we'd like to do is keep 50 asymptomatic slots for the community testing on Wednesdays and then use the rest of the slots for close contact testing and for any other testing that we need to do to get to our capacity of the 100 slots. So that's our plan moving forward. We're going to try it next week and see how that goes.
Okay, thank you. My second question is that I know under Protect Our Neighbors, one of the metrics is to increase, it's not a metric, it's one of the requirements is to have a plan to regarding flu vaccination and preparedness. And are you picturing that will be a large part of our immunization work this year?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked about that because that is something that is going to require some attention because we need, essentially, I've requested a refrigerator, whether there's funding for a refrigerator to keep immunizations in because we don't have one. We have one over in Moffitt County that CDPHE was willing to buy for us. It was, I think, a $6,000 refrigerator. And so we don't have the mechanics right now to be able to house the immunizations themselves. And so they have offered to work with us in order for us to, we're coming in a little bit on the back end of trying to order any flu vaccinations. But one of the ideas we wanted to pursue was more of that outreach of flu and other immunizations out in our rural areas. And that ties to the mobile clinic. And so the short answer, Beth, is yes, we want to do that. And I think that's really one of the pieces for education as well, for the health, whether it's a health educator or nurses doing the education, to make sure that we are doing that outreach.
Thanks. And then the last thing, was that tobacco grant transferred over? That wasn't one that we had before, but I know it was supposed to be.
It will be October 1st.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Okay, that's the October one.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Good morning, everybody. I'm going to touch on three areas. I want to start with a couple observations. Then Emmy and I are going to go through some of the new data looks that we're working on. And then I want to finish up with a discussion about a proposed public health guideline, if you will, for the community on travel policy. So observations, I did note this week that Sweden's experiment is not going well. I don't know, maybe you followed them, but they made a decision to be pretty open from the beginning with certain mitigation issues, but trying to go that route. Well, today, I mean, their current status is that the other European countries are banning travel from them. Their case count has been one of the higher counts rates in the over in Europe, and it's negatively affecting their economy. I think it, even though that's a macro picture thing, I think it plays to our local decisions here in terms of we have to balance both the public health issues and the economic issues. There's not an obvious single pathway, but to go all the way one way or the other has consequences. And I just think that the Sweden example is probably going to show us that, you know, going full open and not paying attention to this disease has economic impact in the long term that'll be bad for their country. The second observation I want to make is about a new study that came out by the National Academy of Sciences. It's another kind of modeling study, but the modeling data is getting pretty robust right now because we've got 6 months of data to play into these things. But they were looking at, you know, where does the infections come from? And in their study, the majority of infections are from people who don't have symptoms. That's both asymptomatic people and then the pre-symptomatic people, those people who will get symptoms but don't have them yet. And that kind of ties into some other evolving understanding that maybe a lot of our cases right now are due to these super spreaders. So there's growing evidence that our biggest infection risk is on the pre-symptomatic people, those people who are going to get symptoms but don't yet demonstrate them, but they spread a lot of virus. And so these studies would suggest that, you know, the majority of our infections that go around are from people who don't have symptoms at the time. So now come back to our local environment where we've been doing our contact tracing. And we have our local cluster of 8 related cases. Many of those cases, and most of those cases we tested as part of contact tracing, many of those cases did not have symptoms at the time that we tested them or the time that they were given quarantine letters. And then they subsequently developed symptoms. This plays into the emphasis, I think, that we need to have on trying to do all this contact testing and catch people as early as we can before even necessarily they have symptoms, because that's when we're probably going to get a lot of our spread in our community. So just a couple observations there. Emmy, you want to put up our dashboard? We, since our last discussion, we've started to rework. We might show data that's relevant to your decision making. And this is a work in project and process. And we've changed it to more of a scroll down look. We're trying to incorporate both protect your neighbor metrics, and then I've tried to incorporate a couple other things, in particular the Harvard Global Health Initiative has some neat data that I think a lot of the people around the US are using. And that shows us, sure, if you wanna click on it there, Emmy, that shows us states and counties cases per 100,000 over a 7-week period. And on the right side there, you see the ranking of states by the number of cases per 100,000 averaged over 7 days. This is what I am seeing people around the country use now when they talk about quarantine guidelines. So the idea being, if you're above this 10 case per 100,000 over a 7-day period, as an average, that you need to quarantine when you go to those states. And so I think there's about 20 states today that rank above the mark. Colorado is a little bit below there. Colorado is currently at 4.3 cases per 100,000. If you haven't seen this, this also allows you to look at specific states. So you can click on Colorado on the left, and then you can click on our county. You're doing an awesome job driving there, Emmy, thanks. And you can see that per their data, we're at 2.8 cases. So I find this helpful. And as we get into our discussion later about a possible travel guideline, this is the kind of data that I think we'll use to delineate which states you need to consider quarantine when you travel to them. So Emmy, if we can go back up to the top now. So at the top here, we have a 7-day average of positive tests. And that average also shows you the positivity rate. You know, we have to try to factor in, are we doing more tests? Is that we're having more positive cases? So the way to partly interpret those numbers of cases is our positivity rate. So when you click on one of the bars there, say the yellow one there, you can see our positivity rates. And so that's the number of positive cases on a given day over the number of tests that were obtained on that given day. And I like this bar picture a little bit better than we've had on the other graphs. And then is another way of looking at this positive test rate. And this also is reflecting or mirroring what the state data presentations are. So it's a 3-day average. It's a rolling 3-day average. And Emmy's got these plotted out here along with a curve. So you can kind of visually get a sense of how our positivity rate is going. And I think we all had the sense that in the past couple of weeks, our positivity rate went up. Then our next graph below that, and this goes into kind of that positivity rate too. And then we need to track, and this is per the Protect Our Neighbors too, we need to track, or go back up just a little bit, Emmy. There we go. We need to track the amount of tests that we're doing, and this graph helps us see how many tests we're doing. So it's a 14-day average per 10,000 population. I still think this is very relevant. This is at Unicast data, and they're looking at three metrics. The first metric there is average mobility based on distance traveled compared to where we were pre-pandemic. And we're in that 25 to 40% range. So we get a D in that area. Now, we have to consider that if I go up into the mountains and go fishing by myself, that's a bad mark on their metric, although I obviously didn't increase my risk by being in contact with anybody. The second thing there is they designate locations as essential or non-essential. And so if you increase the amount of non-essential locations you're going to, that decreases our grade. And then the third metric is how likely a person is in a given hour to have contact with how many other people. And that puts us all into this D plus range. But that's that social distancing thing is an important thing for us to consider. And here you can see it too. Many of the models suggest that we need to be above 45% on our social distancing. Back when we were in early April, we had gotten well above 70%. And what else do we have on there, Emmy, going down? So we also on the Protect Our Neighbor, have a requirement to talk about our hospital capacity, and this is one way we can reflect that. And while we need to pay attention to Route County, we are part of a system in the state of Colorado, so I still think we have to have our eyes on what's going on in the state. So this is what we've been working on. There's a few other tweaks and ideas we've still got to put together for graphs. Because of this work in project, it's missing probably our last few days of data. But that's our attempt to kind of evolve where we were on our data presentation. Questions or comments?
Just a comment for me, Dr. Harrington. I find these graphs much more useful than what was previously on the dashboard. So thanks to you and Emmy for providing these updates. Again, much more helpful to me as a layman to try to understand where we're headed.
I think it's really, really good. This is much, much more useful. The other stuff was fine, but I like this better. Just clarification on what you said, especially because I know there's members of the public and the media listening. I want to make sure there's not confusion. So all those zeros that we have between like July 4th and today, those aren't necessarily accurate, or those are accurate? Just want to make sure I understand.
Correct. They're not accurate for two reasons. One, we have, as we're constructing these, they're not quite living yet, so we're lagging several days on the data input to what we constructed. And then the second factor, which has been an issue all along, is we often don't get test results back for many days, several days from maybe when the tests were submitted. So we sometimes all of a sudden pop up and have to repopulate something back from 3 or 4 days ago. So to your point, these are not quite accurate for today.
Okay. I was just getting nervous. We were going to see a headline in the newspaper about zero cases when maybe just want to make sure everyone knows that's not necessarily true. And then to your last point, and I think this is the only question I have, what day are we recording cases on? Is it when the person was tested? Is it when we get the result back? Is it when symptoms started? How are we doing that?
Almost all this data is based on the date that the test was collected. We have at times looked at the days when symptoms began, and that is something we may still try to go back to putting in here. But almost, I think all this data is based on the date that the test was collected.
Thank you.
Any more questions or comments for Dr. Harrington? Remy?
I just want to add one more, point out one more thing on here. These two metrics here, this one relates to state variances and, you know, the state defined low, medium, and high spread rates. And this will change colors as the cases change. So for instance, we were at like 11 last week and it was in the yellow range. And if we go above 13, this will turn to red. This one is kind of configured to meet the new Protect Our Neighbors, and it's either red or green. And I'm sorry, off the top of my head, I don't know where that break is, but when we go below that, this will turn green.
Thank you, Emmy. All right. Thank you very much for the presentation on the dashboard. Dr. Harrington, I think the next thing you wanted to talk about was some travel ideas.
Yes, throughout all this, it's come up from time to time, how do we deal with people traveling out and return to our area, or maybe visitors come in, what guidance do we have on that? And recently we've had several businesses and other entities in town asking us this too. I think it is time that we put out our recommendations for self-quarantining after travel. And I have floated a proposal with you that's based on things I've looked at through other public health departments around the country. We know that there are certain things that put you at increased risk, so it's worthwhile to remind people about that. But what we're seeing now is a listing of states so that when people travel to these states, they can be conscious of the fact that when they return, they need to then strongly consider self-quarantining themselves for 14 days. We, in the past, I've struggled a little bit to kind of come up with a data way to list which states, but now the, for example, the Harvard Institute of Global Health has their metric, which I think is being used quite a bit around the country, and it has to do with this threshold of number of cases in the past week, and that's what Emmy showed us a little bit earlier. And so you can go right down that anybody above 10%, and this is not necessarily new either, but anybody who's above a 10% test positivity rate or above 10 cases per 100,000 over the 7 days average, those levels then end up indicating that they're a high-risk state and quarantining is recommended. So that would be the general criteria. Then it's an issue of, do we put this out as a policy by our public health department? And then people in the community can use this to refer to. I don't think that we can easily mandate this. And we can certainly have a discussion about that. But then I'd kind of pose those questions to everybody in this group in terms of how we want to move forward with a policy that we would call our own from the public health department, but would be a guidance for those in the community. I don't know if we need to put that up or if everybody has that in front of them.
Well, Dr. Harrington, the presumption is that you and public health think that this is important and it will make a difference in our disease prevalence in Rauch County if folks observe these recommendations.
Yes, and you know, to that point, we may have talked about this before, in the past couple of weeks, we've had a cluster of cases that are all related and we've tracked them out, but we've had at least 5 cases, I believe, where it's clear they traveled out of state to high incidence states and they returned with symptoms or soon got symptoms. It's clear that they contracted the disease where they went. And that applies to individuals, but it applies to businesses too. as they try to consider, well, people are going to travel, but then how do they deal with that as a policy? So this would give them guidance on that, because we've had people asking.
I have a couple of things. The first is, I think this makes a lot of sense given what you have told us about kind of where some of these cases are coming from, and that we are seeing that this is a concern. And then I've also stated just my optimism and my belief that I think people want to protect our community and they want to do the right thing. And having some information to help them make good decisions, I think, is valuable. I'm not supportive of mandating this at this point. I mean, maybe in the future that might be a necessity, but I think just guidance for people. I guess two things. The first is the obvious criticism is we have tourists coming into our community from these locations. And so there's some inconsistency there. We're certainly not asking people to quarantine themselves when they come here on vacation. And I don't think we would do that. That doesn't make a lot of sense. And so I guess, how would we address that inconsistency? And actually, I have some thoughts on that, but I'd be curious about your thoughts. And then the second question is just, I know in what you sent us, really the only option that was mentioned in there in terms of reducing risk was a self-quarantine. I'm wondering if we could put out some other sort of a ranked list of options. You know, if you can't self-quarantine because you have to go to work or because you, whatever it is, you know, what's kind of the next best thing that you could do? You know, is it limiting non-essential visits to businesses? Is it, you know, making sure that in your workplace you have adequate separation? You know, if we're talking about a business putting in place some policies for their employees, you know, is it, well, they can't self-quarantine because they're not able to work from home, but they usually work in really close quarters with other people, and we're going to make sure they have their own space so that we reduce the risk. So I guess I'm wondering if we could put some other recommendations too, recognizing that self-quarantine is not going to be a realistic possibility for everyone. So those are just the two things that I wonder if you might address.
No, I think those are both very pertinent points. What we've seen in some states, it's easy if you're Hawaii. So we've already, you know, Hawaii has a mandatory tourist quarantine. If you're gonna come visit Hawaii at the airport, they grab you and they track you, and you got a 14-day self-quarantine. That's the one extreme. I think then we're not gonna do that. We can't, that's not practical either. I think, though, if we have the guideline up there, we will leave it to people to decide how they're going to incorporate that as possible. And tourists covers a broad range. We have a lot of people that come here for 2 or 3 months, and they have the ability then to do more of a self-quarantine. I don't know of a practical way that we're going to kind of affect this with people coming here for a 3 or 4 day weekend. So I'm not proposing that that's going to be the case. But I do think we can make an impact to some degree on some portion of, in particular, our residents in our community who are traveling out and coming back. I think that's where this is gonna be most pertinent. I don't have a clear answer for you on the tourist thing. That is a contrast or a conflict, if you will. Then on the second issue, yes, I love that idea. There's the self-quarantine of locking yourself in a room and not coming out for 2 weeks. But I think in reality, there's a lot of steps in between. And what I'm hoping is, well, people will see this policy and use it to consider their own risk for where they're going, and then use that to decide what steps they need to make to kind of self-mitigate when they come back. And so perhaps what we need to do is have a broader definition of what self-quarantine is to include all these different things, such as what you suggested, Commissioner Mellon.
One thought I had this morning about the tourist question, one could possibly argue that there's a little bit different risk in just the types of activities that someone who's here on a 3 or 4 day weekend might engage in. They're really unlikely to be mingling with a bunch of different people from different households in a private residence, you know, they're much more likely to be in a restaurant or in a retail store where we have some other kinds of things in place for protection. They're not going to be in, you know, they're not going to be going to work while they're here, right? They're not going to be, like I said, kind of at these house party type environments that we've been a little bit concerned about. So while it's not perfect, I do think there is some argument to be made that an individual tourist is probably going to have less contact with a broad group of people in the community, especially given the mitigation measures that are in place in a business. While that's sort of a broad assumption, I don't feel like it's a totally unreasonable assumption either, and may just be one point of reference in thinking about these kinds of guidelines.
And the ask that we have had from the community on this has been specifically employers. It's been people asking, how do we deal with our employees? That's the only ask we've had on this, so to speak. So our intent has been driven partly by that.
So even with these, you know, we were having this discussion yesterday and talking about even our own employees, and if our own employees are going out, you know, and there's a whole different discussion about, well, we went to a hotspot, but did you participate in the hotspot, or were you just there visiting your grandma that doesn't go out as well? And I don't know how I think there's still some self, and I think Dr. Harrington, you referred to that. There's still some self-responsibility here things that people need to, you know, it isn't so much that you're going to a hotspot, it's what you do when you get to the hotspot. And the same thing here, I guess, too. And when we have our visitors come in, so are you out there, you know, I think probably why they're shutting down all the bars right now. So again.
Well, I do think, Doug, that the guidelines actually address that point, because they reference what kind of activities were you engaged in while you were visiting that hotspot state. So,
yeah, and I was going to say similarly, I think that's the benefit of doing this as a guideline. I mean, and the message really is about personal responsibility, and then employers, as Dr. Harrington said, and including the county, you know, have asked what can we do when an employee goes on vacation and comes back? How do we make sure that we keep our other employees safe? And so these are definitely recommendations that employers would take a look at. And then someone who is leaving town on a vacation, but wants to know and needs to know how to protect the community from them unintentionally bringing cases back. So I guess my question is, Brian, what's the follow-up on this? I know we had that initial document. Are you going to maybe make some revisions based on the conversation we've had and send that to us again?
Yes. What I would propose is that I incorporate a broader list of what you can do short of kind of locking yourself in a room for 14 days. So we'll flesh that out a bit better. I did intend that we would embed some references to the CDPHE and CDC quarantine guidelines for people to reference. And then we'll also embed the reference to the Harvard Global Health Initiative, just so people can look up themselves kind of the rankings of those states. So we'll massage this a bit further and then return it to you for your approval or further input.
One other question I have on that, I can't remember in that document, did we also say avoid traveling to hotspots if you can? I mean, was that also in that document? Because that seems
we could
include.
Yes. And then I also, obviously, I want to have Robin included in this a bit too. We may want to, there might be some ways of sprucing up or kind of working on the messaging of it.
Yeah, I was just that was going to be the other thing I would mention, is just on the messaging side. I do think we have to be careful to message this the right way. You know, that these are not requirements, these are guidelines. And we're really putting that out there for the community's information and to support people in making good, responsible decisions when they do travel.
How would you like to label this? And I mention this because I see in the future we may have some other instances where it makes sense for us to put out some guidelines. Do we want to call this public health guidelines? How do you want to have this labeled?
I think we should defer to Robin's messaging expertise.
Okay.
we're not very good at that. That's
When you ask us, we get ourselves in trouble.
Yep.
Okay. We'll call it Bob's words. I don't know. All right. That's all I have for you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Harrington. Are there any more questions for Dr. Harrington and or Carrie?
Tim, this probably isn't a question for either of them, but I'm noting that we're getting some emails in, and I know Steamboat Radio shared yesterday about the discussion we had about restaurant enforcement. I had some follow-up conversation yesterday that made me understand that our staff is working with those restaurants, and they have the option of removing a food license, but that they believe that they are going to be able to achieve compliance without doing that. And then we also have had questions of, well, can we publicize who these restaurants are so that people aren't eating there? And I don't see that Scott is here, unfortunately. He might be the best person to address that question, but just because we're getting questions, and I think folks were expecting us to discuss this during the Board of Health meeting, I'd like us to maybe just take the opportunity to address that. And so I don't know who is best to do that.
Well, I can express an opinion, which is that I don't think it's our role as the Board of Health to repeat for public consumption miscellaneous complaints that are coming in that we, at least as commissioners at this point in time, have any way of verifying the truth of those allegations. So I agree. I would defer to legal and to environmental health as to what the correct protocol for that is.
Carrie seems to know, so we can let her speak.
I was just going to say that according to Heather Savalox, for the complaints that we've received, they are alleged until they are proven to be true. And I think we have to be really careful about any disparaging of businesses in our community, because from my experience working with the contact tracing team and all of that, for the large part, restaurants have been very cooperative and want to do the right thing. So that would be my comment to that.
Eric seems ready.
I guess before Eric talks, I'd be really hesitant to have a naughty list. So, you know, I'm not really, you know, and again, personal responsibility and a business responsibility too. I do feel that we actually have some teeth with the restaurant licensing procedure, but, you know, and Eric's already talked about that with us yesterday. So again, I'll let Eric talk.
So I agree with all of what was said, but in addition to that, we don't ever, as a matter of practice, publicize complaints and the fact that monitoring a complaint or going after a property owner in a land use situation or anything like that. All of that said, though, there may be an occasion where the restaurant forces our hand to do some sort of a public notice. For example, when the restaurant does not do collect proper contact tracing information and we get a positive test from that restaurant, that may force our hand to do some sort of a public notice to try to collect that information via that public notice. And I don't know how else to do that other than publish it in the newspaper.
I see that Scott has joined us. Scott, have you been following this recent part of the conversation?
I was following on Facebook and trying to do some other work. And so just jumped on. I haven't heard anything that I disagreed with. You know, we really, the goal here is really to get facilities into compliance and, you know, use those more forceful actions as a last resort. And I think that we've been successful so far. It hasn't always been easy, but, you know, I think that we're kind of rounding into form in terms of the processes that we're going through. Beth was going to try to get some assistance from other counties with a more specific enforcement plan and incremental steps. So we formalize that a little bit better. There may be a situation that forces our hand, but so far we haven't quite gotten there yet. And it seems like the establishments that we've had trouble with, we're making headway and things are improving.
So I guess I would just summarize. I want to just make it clear to business owners and to community members that are concerned that we take these violations seriously and we follow up on them, but we also don't take it lightly, the idea of closing a business or removing a restaurant license, and that our goal is to work with these establishments to get them into compliance first, but that we would not hesitate to take appropriate enforcement action if it were required. And I think that's the top line, and that's what I just would like. I assume we all agree on that, and I want to make sure that that's clear to everyone.
Yeah, I agree with that summary. And I'm not saying Doug disagree.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about it. You know, I at some point in time, you know, if the matter continues, you know, I don't know, we need to maybe have some more discussion on it, and maybe we have, you know, a naughty list, and so, you know, and that way, you know, let the customers decide whether they want to go to a place that's a naughty list. So I hate to do that too. So, and again, short of the legal system as well, but, you know, and due process, but.
And, you know, we are discussing the gaps, the oversight gaps that we have. You know, staff visits those establishments upon appointment during the day. And so we have little or no coverage at night or on weekends. And so we are looking for some more support to increase that oversight presence. And that's something that goes along with Protect Your Neighbor. And so that's ongoing also.
I would also just encourage people to vote with their dollars, if you will. I mean, I think that unlike a traditional food safety violation, a public health violation is pretty apparent. You know, if staff is not wearing masks, if customers are not being required to wear masks, if there's not good distancing going on, if you're not asked to provide your contact information when you arrive at a restaurant, just leave. Would be my message to the community. I mean, I think, you know, if people are concerned about the naughty list, they can see with their own eyes whether an establishment is following the rules or not. And I think I would encourage them to make their opinions clear on that front.
And the part that I would like to add is, I'm not sure about this, but I don't believe that there's a single restaurant in unincorporated Route County. I believe virtually all restaurants reside within our municipalities, and I would certainly be looking to our municipal partners to participate in compliance with public health orders within their own boundaries. So it is just about 11 o'clock. And I believe that's when we scheduled public comment. But before I go to public comment, I just want to circle back to public health and the commissioners to see if there's any other questions or comments they have before we conclude this part of the meeting.
I'm sorry to keep dragging out, but another concern or question, and I imagine we won't have time to discuss this today, but I'd like to put it out there for consideration, and maybe we could discuss next week. I keep getting comments and questions from community members that I would characterize as, what are the thresholds for us to do X, Y, and Z, you know, to close businesses, to increase public health restrictions, to do whatever. Generally, I feel like there's so many unknowns that it's really hard for us to say, here's exactly what will happen. But there does seem to be, I'm not surprised, right? There's a desire for certainty. I think all of us have a desire for certainty. And would just like to, I guess, address that that is a question and a concern that seems to have been brought up on multiple occasions by various community members. And maybe just something for us to think about how, you know, what are the things we could say in regards to that? Of course, I recognize that the degree of certainty is practically zero with this whole thing. But I do think to the extent we can have some conversation and think about that discussion, I think there would be some value in it. And like I said, I don't think we probably have time to do that today, but perhaps it's something we could have more discussion about next week.
Sounds good. Anybody else before we move on to public comment? Okay. So Kendra, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Kendra. Would you, for the benefit of our attendees, quickly describe our public comment process?
Yeah, so the way public comment works is you would raise your hand. If you're on the computer, you would just use the raise your hand function. If you're on the phone, to do that, it's *9. So if you'll raise your hand now, if you want to make a comment, a public comment, then I'll go down the line. And I'll call on you and allow you to speak at that time.
So I am seeing one individual that has raised their hand. Would that individual please identify themselves and then go ahead and make public comment?
Hi, is that me? I've never done this before. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for everything you're doing. And I work in a local area fast food restaurant, and I felt like my best protection with all the tourism, and of course wanting that to continue, is your mask mandate. And it's worked out so well where I work, and I feel much safer because of it. And I just urge you and hope that you would continue that for those of us who are, you know, quote unquote, essential workers in the front lines and meeting just hundreds of people every day, trying to keep social distance, but still, you know, we have to clean bathrooms that people have just been in and so on. Anyway, thank you so much for everything you're doing. And I just, with everything I have in me, I'd love the mask mandate to continue.
Ma'am, if you don't mind, would you mind identifying yourself for the record?
Oh, hi, yes, absolutely. My name is Joan Burke. I've been in Rout County for about 3 years, and I work at a local area fast food. And I love Rout County and glad to be here and so amazed by all of you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Burke. Is there anyone else that's interested in making public comment? I am not seeing any raised hands on the list of call-in listeners or the ones that are connected by computer. So, seeing no raised hands, I will close public comment at this time. And if there's, going back to the commissioners and public health, any last thoughts, comments, or questions before we adjourn? I am not seeing anything. So thank you very much, Carrie and Dr. Harrington, for joining us today and giving us the update. Thank you, Emmy, for the work that you've been doing on the dashboard. That's very helpful. And thanks to all of you. And we will adjourn at this time.
See you tomorrow. Thank you. Good luck with those cows, Doug.